Welcome to How Not to Think podcast. In today's show, I am delighted to introduce Jonas Goldson, who is a fascinating man with a lot of interesting experience and an emphasis on ethics, which in today's world is sometimes relegated into the background, and particularly during these times, we don't want to forget how important and how critical and how essential an ethical foundation is. So this is the How Not to Think podcast. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and we'll get straight to it. Welcome, Jonas. How are you today?
I'm wonderful, Howard. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, great, great. We connected a short while ago and found we had a lot of mutual interests in writing my book, I Think, Therefore I'm Wrong. I really came to the conclusion, long after you did, I think, that virtue is the basis of wisdom. And a lot of your work as a rabbinical scholar, as an expert, as a speaker, as an author, really focuses on how important ethics are. So anyway, let's give our listeners a bit of background on you and your story.
Well, I graduated more years ago than I like to think from the University of California with a degree in English. And I put that degree to good use by going hitchhiking across the United States, crossing the Atlantic and going backpacking across Europe. And after a year, I ended up in Israel. And that's where I reconnected with the tradition of my people, the Jewish tradition. I'd been raised with really no knowledge whatsoever what that meant. And so it was a new discovery for me to, you know, where we say we're all looking for ourselves. The problem is that sometimes we don't have to look that far if we pay attention. But sometimes we have to go halfway around the world to discover what we already had if we would have known to look for it. And I just discovered a wealth of wisdom and purpose and direction and context for life. I ended up living in Israel for 9 years, met my wife there, had our first two children there, became an ordained rabbi, and then embarked on a career teaching high school, Jewish high school, trying to communicate to students and teenagers the same wisdom that I had found to help them. And certainly teenagers are very much at odds with themselves most of the time. And if we can make it through that part of our lives with a little more clarity, a little more foundation, then when we come out on the other side, we'll be better prepared to engage life in a productive way. So I taught for 23 years, first in Budapest, Hungary, then in Atlanta, Georgia, then for 20 years here in St. Louis, where I live now. And when I retired from teaching 3 years ago, I embarked on a new career as a keynote speaker, talking about ethics and trying to communicate to professionals and leaders why good ethics is good business. And really what attracted me to your theme, your message, your mission, is that it's very easy for us to become so focused on short-term gains that we forget about long-term goals. And so the way you send it, you phrase it, you sum it up so nicely, how not to think. There are so many bad thinking patterns that we get into. And I think one of the most fundamental is that we have to choose between being good and being successful.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting yeah, one, which we'll perhaps get to a little later. I'm just fascinated by, I wonder how teenagers who, for those of you who don't know, the frontal lobe, the frontal cortex, which is really the main way of exercising control of your life and not being impulsive, the frontal cortex actually doesn't fully develop until mid to late 20s. So that might explain the impetuousness of youth. But I was just interested, as you were teaching high school students, you know, teenagers, about this, what the reaction typically was.
Well, my style of teaching has always been to start with something provocative, confrontational, counterintuitive as an attention getter. So in fact, I have a book called Proverbial Beauty, which is takes excerpts from King Solomon's Book of Proverbs. And every chapter is presenting something that we perceive generally, we intuitively think of as a negative, and demonstrating how to reframe it as a positive. And I absorb much of this from my rabbi. He would often tell us in the middle of discussing Jewish law, he would say, "Jewish courts don't care about the truth." And you know, it's those types of statements that make you say, "What? Hang on. I want to know, what's he, this is a rabbi, he's got a long beard, and he's got the side locks and a long black coat and the thick glasses, and he's telling me Jewish law, Jewish courts don't care about the truth. How can that be?" And it's really very simple that we never know the truth. You know, people who say they know the truth, those are people you want to be wary of, because we can get close to the truth. We can play. Ultimately, life is a game of probabilities. What are the odds? You know, if I cross the street without looking both ways, I might make it. I might not. Okay, there aren't too many cars coming. Maybe my odds are better. But how do I gauge the risk versus the payoff? It takes so little effort to look both ways. What's the benefit of playing odds, even when they're in my favor? So this approach to life, what is empirical evidence say? What does logic and reason say? What does the wisdom, the accumulated wisdom of mankind say? We're so quick, you know. Now in business, they talk about the what do they call it? The shiny new object syndrome. You know, every time you go online, somebody's got a new program and a new app and a new technology, and it's so exciting. This is going to solve all your problems. And wait a second, I haven't finished actually putting into practice the last thing that I started with, and I never give myself the chance to succeed. So it's really it's a mindset, and teenagers want to be engaged. They don't want to be told what's right. They want to be participants. And so by throwing out these provocative statements and getting them to become partners, and let's understand what this really means. Let's understand what's really going on here. That I found was a very successful formula for drawing them in and keeping them focused.
Yes, I'm sure you do a great job of that. And again, when you get down to the heart of wisdom, it's knowing, being aware of what you don't know, and the limitation of what you know, and the tendency to make something a hard fact when it's, as you rightly say, just a probability. And I probably use this quote many times on previous podcast, but I'm not ashamed to use it again. George Box, a famous British statistician, once said about scientific models, but I think it applies to all ideas too, "All models are wrong, some are useful." All ideas are wrong in some way. You know, we've simplified them and taken out the nuance and just say this is a fact because it's easier to do that. And it doesn't take that much effort. But we lose the subtlety of it, and we lose sight of the fact that it is not 100% certain. There's things we're missing, right?
Yeah, you remind me of the quote. I don't know. I don't remember who said it, but there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Right.
Then when you simply have raw data without context and without interpretation, you can prove anything you want.
Absolutely.
And the wisdom guides us in recognizing that truth always lies a level beneath wherever we are, and that our willingness to re-examine and reconsider. I was once telling my students, I taught them the term ideologue, Now, this is in a religious Jewish high school, mm-hmm. where most of us are Orthodox and believe very firmly in the absolute immutable truth that God handed down to Moses. And so one of my students said, "Aren't we ideologues?" And I said, "Good question. No. Because if you think you have a proof or you have evidence that challenges what I believe, I want to hear it. And if you convince me I'm wrong, I'll cut off my beard. I'll go get a ham sandwich. I'm not interested in living this lifestyle because it's beautiful or appealing or fulfilling. I follow because it's I believe it's true. And if you think I'm wrong, tell me why." I think at this point, after 40 years of study and investigation, it's unlikely that you'll have something compelling to tell me. But I'm willing to listen. You know, if you tell me you believe in leprechauns, I'll also listen, but probably not for very long because I suspect that you don't have much basis to go on.
Right. Right. Now, one of the things, of course, that you have done is taken this whole idea of ethics and the importance of ethics into the business world, too. And I know you speak a lot to organizations and businesses about that. What has been the reaction to that? And what do you see, particularly this is being recorded at the time of the COVID-19 epidemic, where in a crisis, you would hope wisdom would appear. What has been, as you've tried to introduce this into or talk about it in business settings and in the context of, you know, let's face it, capitalism, what sort of reaction have you got?
By and large, positive. I was talking to another speaker who's very established and talks about trust. And he said to me privately, he says, "Really, I talk about ethics." He says, "But ethics is harder to sell because people either think they have it or it's too late."
Right.
Which itself is worrisome. But I've found that even since I've only been at this about 3 years and just scrolling through LinkedIn, I've noticed a big jump in the attention that ethics is getting just in the last couple of years. It's one of those things where pretty much everybody recognizes or admits it's important. The problem is, what do we do about it? And you know, in business, they talk about hard skills and soft skills. And a lot of the gurus tell us those are counterproductive terminologies, because if you want to have a smooth running business, it's not enough to just be good at sales and marketing and management. You have to develop a culture in which everyone is committed to the goals, to the ideals, to the vision. I mean, Simon Sinek is probably the most articulate voice in this area. His last book called The Infinite Game is talking about how successful businesses don't compete against other businesses. It's they have a vision. And when you look at successful businesses that are able to articulate to themselves, to their employees, to their clients and their customers, that we are about more than just a product, and we are about more than just profits. And you can communicate that in a way that's compelling and inspiring. Employees become impassioned and engaged and loyal and more productive, and consumers and customers. I mean, I want to patronize businesses and companies that I admire, that I respect. And that's what creates brand loyalty. So in principle, everybody's on board. In practice, like everything, it's a lot more complicated.
And there's, of course, a lot of work going back a few years now on engagement and showing how engagement absolutely improves, you know, productivity and success, and really the basis of those engagement rules really are around a culture of trust, authenticity, that creates loyalty and engagement. It's not that complicated, but in practice, obviously, it is, because that is competing against things like the bottom line, how many sales we made, et cetera, et cetera. But all of those things really come back down to, come back down to your ethical basis.
And in fact, just this morning, as I was getting ready to talk with you, my wife in the next room, who's working from home like many of us, was getting extremely aggravated because a function on her computer for her work was that she really doesn't use much or hasn't used much because she hasn't needed to, and now she has to, and it's so complicated, it's so convoluted, and you know, this, I believe, is also an ethics issue. In other words, to make things more difficult for my employees than they need to be, I'm robbing them of their time, I'm sapping their mental energy, I'm causing them unnecessarily stress and frustration and aggravation, and who's that ultimately hurting? Me.
Right.
Because they're not going to be performing anywhere near peak efficiency. And they're not going to be motivated to get the job done because they're finding it so onerous to get through the layers of inefficiency.
Right. No, absolutely. And although you say most people are aware of ethical issues and how that bears ultimately on what they do, I don't know that everyone understands the sort of thing you've just talked about, that, yeah, are there really ways of making this easier? Because if I make it easier, you're going to get more engagement. How can I do that? Rather than just saying, well, they let them work it out for themselves, or they should be able to do it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, because ultimately, my understanding of ethics, is simple, to make it as simple as possible, it's an awareness of how my actions affect those around me and the world around me. And that operates on both an individual level and a collective level. Means my basic outlooks and attitudes towards life define and determine what kind of a member of society I'm going to become. My specific actions determine what impact I'm going to have on people that I come in contact with on a day-to-day basis. So we can take the focus very, very narrow and one-on-one, or we can take it cosmic and universal and global. And you know, I put out recently a video, and I put it out in ebook form, an article on the 5 ethical insights from the coronavirus. And the first one is everything you do matters. Because while there's still some debate about how this whole thing got started, they believe they've traced it to one of these, I think they call them wet markets in China, with all these exotic types of animals that have all sorts of exotic types of diseases. And so, you know, I decided I wanted to have hedgehog or bat or what, snake for dinner. Well, that's my decision. I'm not hurting anyone else unless I sought off a global contagion. So you can debate the specific situations. But it's a terrible fallacy to think that what I do in my private life is not affecting the world around me.
Yeah, absolutely. And this virus probably is a fantastic metaphor for that. We're talking about physical space and so forth, but really it shows how interconnected we are, how important that is, and how any action you take can reverberate and echo through many, many people across space, across time. And we're not just talking about physical things like viruses. We can talk of things like ideas, fake news. A sensitive one for both of us, I'm sure for you, is, I think like 30% of people in the world now disbelieve the Holocaust happened. Mm-hmm. Which is mind-blowing and sad, yeah. And sad, you know, very sad. What were the other things that came out? You said five things that coronavirus has taught us. What were the others?
Well, one actually you just mentioned is that what you don't see can hurt you. And you've really framed it just right, that in the same way, I mean, you don't have to go back that far. What, 100 years? I think, who was it? Was it Lister who developed germ theory or recognized germ theory?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I believe so.
And it was very controversial at the time. You know, they used to think that microorganisms simply, well, they didn't even know what they were, but that, for instance, I think flies, they thought they could say spontaneously generated, right? Because you leave out a piece of meat or you leave out some vegetables that get moldy or rotted, and before long you see these maggots appear, and then they start hatching into flies. And you know, nobody considered the possibility that the flies are actually laying their eggs in a place where they're going to be attracted to these bacteria that are growing there. And maybe it was Rousseau, I don't remember, whether one of the early scientists, he had a very simple experiment. He took a piece of raw meat and he put it in an airtight container. And he put another one next to it without the airtight. And lo and behold, one developed maggots and flies, the other one didn't.
Right.
So it's not always very difficult to demonstrate that the things we take for granted are wrong. It just takes that creativity and that willingness to look at things in a different way. But in the same way that microorganisms, now we understand that things we can't see can be fatal, and as we know now, extremely disruptive to our lives. So as you said so well, ideas, concepts, the influence of other people. I love Jim Rohn's quote, "You are the five people you spend the most time with." Choosing our company, exposing ourselves to unethical people and people who have moral illness or moral infection, that has an effect on us. Think about what passes for so much of our entertainment nowadays. I'm not the only one to make this observation, but we really are living in the Roman Empire in many ways, with the bread and circuses. There's an entitlement culture. I think the state should take care of me, and I want to be entertained. And what are the things that entertain us? I mean, look at late night television, if you care to. How much cynicism? How much slander, how much gossip, humor at the expense of others that's entirely gratuitous, you know, in misinformation, which is what we called it before we called it fake news.
Fake news, yeah.
all of these things, they damage our psyches, they damage our souls, they have a corrosive effect on society. And, coming from a theological point of view, we believe very much in we don't use this terminology, but it's essentially the same idea, karma, that there's a spiritual biofeedback and symbiosis in the universe, and that what we send out eventually comes back.
Right.
And that if we don't value our relationships, if we don't treat people with respect, if we aren't committed to truth, if we don't look for substance and depth in our interaction with human people, well, look how cut off we all are now. And yet, on the other hand, ironically, the internet, which is responsible for so much of our superficiality that's taken over the culture, is now having the opposite effect, is it's now the medium through which people can connect. I mean, everybody's complaining that we're stuck in our houses and we can't go anywhere. Can you imagine if this happened 30 years ago,
yep,
before Zoom, before Netflix,
yep,
I mean, we'd be reading books.
Oh no! Oh my God! There'd be no podcasts. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And what you're talking about here is very important because, you know, there's something in psychology that I mentioned in my book, I think Therefore I'm Wrong, called temporal discounting, which means we really live in the present. And we can justify, live in the present. We discount the future, which means that we don't necessarily think about how our actions are going to reverberate through the world and affect other people. We can justify anything we want, pretty much, and we do that a lot of the time. And so it's very easy to get away from these sort of high concepts of, you know, whether it's compassion or honesty or mercy or kindness or all of those virtues. It's very easy to either justify you doing it, deny you're not doing it, and actually most of the time, not even think about it. Not even think about it, right? I mean, I wonder, I'm hearing reports now of middlemen making lots of money selling essential goods to hospitals like ventilators and masks. What do we think about that?
Yeah, well, you know, there are always going to be opportunists. Mm-hmm. There's apparently a whole new phenomenon of people hacking into Zoom meetings. I do like it when pop culture gets it right.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because there's an accessibility about pop culture, and so, you know, in the Batman movies with the Joker, and Batman's trying, Bruce Wayne's trying to figure out, you know, what to do about this guy, and Alfred the butler says to him, "Some people just want to watch the world burn."
True,
and it's a mentality that I just can't wrap my head around. I mean, it baffles me, and I suppose that there are two ways we can validate our existence. Or let's say there's one way we can validate our existence is to make a difference in the world. Well, making a positive difference takes work and takes energy and takes talent and takes skill and takes discipline and takes a certain amount of luck, or let's mm-hmm. say divine providence, because mm-hmm. lots of people work really hard and don't see that they're making a difference. Of course, it goes back to the previous conversations. We make a positive difference in ways we don't recognize.
Correct.
If I have a family, if I'm good at my job, if I'm respected in my neighborhood, my community, I'm going to be famous or rich to have an influence. But it's a lot easier to have a destructive influence. You know, one match.
Right. There you go.
And you can make a big difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people, they just would rather take the easy path. It's easier to flip over the game board than it is to try to win the game by the rules.
Yeah. Again, I'd like to go back to the five principles that are being shown up, or ethics as far as the virus. What are the others?
Well, let's see. Do I go through them in order? Or maybe I'll go to them out of order. That the last one is, don't wait for the next crisis. In other words, when we learn about everything I do matters, that's one. Right. Don't expose myself to unethical people. Right, that's two. What I can't see can't hurt me. Right. We need one another. Is four. Even when we're cut off, we're. You know, even with social distancing, we're locked in our houses. Right? We are desperate to connect, as we're doing right now, through this type of medium. Right. So take those four lessons, and then the fifth lesson is, let's learn them.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's. You know, the crisis will pass. We will get through this. Things will go back to some semblance of normalcy. But that's when we always blow it.
Absolutely.
You know, when you've got a common enemy, you come together. as soon, I mean, this is the story of the Jewish people. You know, we go from crisis to crisis and redemption to redemption. And boy, you want to tick off God.
Don't it's learn, not, right?
It's not making mistakes that gets God upset. It's not learning from them, or really even worse than that, learning from them and then forgetting the lesson. Because if we could come together, I mean, you talk about the opportunists who are trying to profit and benefit from this type of thing, but look at all the wonderful stories of people who are being selfless, of people who are looking for ways to give and to help and to support others, the outreach of kindness and mercy and thoughtfulness. There is so much good that comes out of a crisis like this. And when it's over, what do? We go right back into our narrow focus, and we forget those lessons, and we stop reaching out, we stop looking for things, and that's when we blow it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure that how you'd feel about this line that I came up with, which was, God is a coach, not a therapist, in the sense that you got to learn. You know, you've got to learn from these things. We're not going to talk about them endlessly. You got to learn from them because they're going to come back, and you need to learn for your own security, safety, health, and as an obligation to society and that everyone else. We all need to learn from this.
I think you said it nicely, in the same way that parents and teachers, our goal should be to make ourselves obsolete. I want to teach my children and my students to think for themselves, to think clearly for themselves,
right?
Absolutely. To be disciplined. Right. I don't want them running to me every time they have a problem, right? And in a sense, that's how we see our relationship with God, is He gave us the wisdom that we need to live good, moral, upright lives that make the world a wonderful place to live in. And yes, we need to refer back to His teachings, but it is interesting that according to our theology, there was an era of prophecy, basically 1,000 years after Sinai, when the Jews had access to prophets who could tell them, are we on course? Are we making good decisions? Are we getting it right? Or come and tell the people, you got this wrong. It's not going to end well. And what happened is that over time, the spiritual level of the world declined until eventually the phenomenon of prophecy was no longer consistent with the spiritual level of human beings. And so now it comes to us, that wisdom comes to us through the ancient teachings, but it makes us more responsible for ourselves. We have to go look for that wisdom. It's not going to come to us unless we go looking for it.
Right. And that requires effort, you know, and a lot of effort. And for a lot of people, going to look for wisdom today is probably not on their to-do list, you know.
And if it is, they may not be looking in the places where they're likely to find it.
That's exactly right. So, of course, where do you find it? And in your, I think it's your most recent book, you use King Solomon's work to elucidate the virtue and wisdom. Tell us a little bit about that.
King Solomon was an extraordinary figure in history. He was the son of King David. King David established the dynasty of the Jewish monarchy. And his son Solomon was the first one to inherit the throne. And he inherited at the age of 12.
Yeah, I know. I read that. Wow.
Now, that being said, people tended to be a lot more mature back then than they are now. I mean, we don't have to look very far to see people in their 60s and 70s who are lacking right. a measurable amount of maturity. But according to the scripture, God came to Solomon and said, what can I do for you? Ask me a request. I'll grant you anything you want. And Solomon says, give your servant an understanding heart to lead your people, which itself was a demonstration of profound wisdom. He recognized that he was inexperienced, he was young, and he had a monumental task to face of not just running a country, but guiding a spiritual people in a spiritual mission. And so he could have asked for wealth, he could have asked for power, he could have asked for all the sorts of things that we imagine when we rub the lamp and the genie comes out and gives us three wishes.
Right.
But what he asked for was the guidance to fulfill his purpose and his mission. And God replies to him, because you asked not for yourself, I am going to give you greater wisdom than any person has ever had or ever will have.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And so over the course of his life, what's interesting about the book of Proverbs is in many places there doesn't seem to be any particular order to the Proverbs or much cohesion between one and the next or one section and the next. And it's because what Solomon did is through the course of his life is he recorded the insights and the inspirations that he had as he had them. And so you don't need to look at the book in chronological sequence. You can skip around and look for what resonates, which is what I did, is I took out a dozen different excerpts of 3, 4, 5 verses at a time. And then because the language of 3,000 years ago is a little bit different from our language now, I looked for examples in news headlines, in scientific discoveries, in folk tales, in pop culture, anything that I felt could help bring the language of 3,000 years ago to the modern ear, and structured a series of observations where King Solomon is showing us how to view the world counterintuitively and how to find truths that are not immediately evident, not by diving deep necessarily, but sometimes just by scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. And there's so much inspiration and guidance and wisdom to be found there. It was a fascinating exercise writing the book. In many ways, the book seemed to write itself. Mm-hmm. I skimmed through the book of Proverbs and find what looked like a compelling excerpt, and then all of a sudden, it just seemed to flow. So
tell the listeners again the name of the book and where they can find it.
Proverbial Beauty. The subtitle is Secrets for Success and Happiness from the Wisdom of the Ages. Best place to find it is on Amazon. Mm-hmm. But it's also linked on my website, which is my name, jonasengoldson.com.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about a 12-year-old getting an offer today from God about anything, and I can't imagine that an Xbox Pro wouldn't have been on the list, you know. but good for Solomon. He was one smart kid, clearly.
Yeah, there's a fascinating discussion the sages bring down that one of the sages was asked. It says, and in fact, Solomon says this himself, he says, God gives wisdom to the wise. So this wealthy woman challenged one of the sages. She said, why doesn't he give wisdom to the foolish? They need it. And he said to her, you're a wealthy woman. Imagine two people come to you for a loan. One of them has property, tracts of land, and the other has nothing. Which one's going to get the loan? Well, the guy with the property. Well, but the other guy needs it more. Yeah, but I want my money back. and he says it's the same thing, that wisdom is not information.
Right.
Wisdom is not data or knowledge or facts.
Right.
Wisdom is a mindset.
Absolutely.
It's a way of looking at the world. And so a person has to have an element of that first in order to benefit from more of it.
Yeah, and that's
otherwise it becomes self-serving.
Yeah, that's a very important point. How wisdom is interpreted. Wisdom is not necessarily intelligence. It's not necessarily related to qualifications, degrees, or how smart you are as measured on an IQ test. Wisdom is the ability to understand what you don't understand, understand your thinking, how these things, how ideas get generated, be able to evaluate them. Having that mindset of questioning, it also involves, I believe, emotional control, because if you don't have emotional control, your emotions are going to run the show and you're not going to be able to make any wise decision at all. And it really is interesting. Recently, as I was finishing I Think Therefore I'm Wrong, I found some research which shows that people who practice gratitude, humility, mercy, actually their frontal cortex is more developed, which means that they are much more able to control their emotions and stand back in a wise way and look objectively at their own thinking about ideas. And I think that's, I'm sure that's true. Now, which comes first, you know, a well-developed frontal cortex or the wisdom? Who knows? But the point is that it absolutely changes the brain in a way that enables you to do that. And I think that's very important.
Yeah. And that's where it's wonderful when you see the science and the philosophy come together. There's a study that was done, I wrote it up in an essay, that they offered little children, very young, the opportunity to take candies and either eat them themselves or feed them to like puppets. And then they filmed this, and they you know, through the technology, they could register the emotional response. And they found that the little children, they took much more pleasure feeding the puppets than they did eating the chocolate themselves. That giving is an impulse that it just develops us on every level, and it makes us happier. And it's sad that our society is, it so easily inclines us to be takers rather than givers. Adam Grant has a wonderful book called Give and Take, where you know he shows that there has to be a balance. Is there people who are they overgive and they burn out, right? And there are people who take and they're toxic people. And it's learning how to balance those two impulses, to take what I need, to give what I can. And the people who master that are the people who are tremendously successful and tend to be the happiest.
Yes, that's true. It's interesting looking at studies on happiness. You know, typically over about up to about $70,000 a year, money really doesn't. Over $70,000 a year, money does not add to happiness at all. And one of the interesting things, somebody then did a study on that, looking at millionaires and people who had a couple million dollars and people who had more than 10 million. And there was a difference in happiness. And the reason was the people who had that mega wealth of 10 million found purpose in giving it away.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've also, a fascinating study, it's a little grim, but they compared lottery winners with people who became paralyzed, paraplegics, quadriplegics, mm-hmm. And they found that 6 months later, both groups had returned to the same level of happiness they'd been on before these dramatic and traumatic incidents.
Interesting, yeah.
It shows how much of it's internal and how much of it's mindset.
Yeah,
we think that these external things are going to make us happy. In my book, I have to take Thomas Jefferson to task for coming up with this phrase, the pursuit of happiness. I think he just did a terrible disservice to all of us, because happiness is not something you pursue.
That's exactly
happiness
right.
is the natural byproduct of living a purpose-driven life.
Yep.
And having a feeling part of something greater than oneself, and feeling that I'm fulfilling my potential to leave the world better than I found it. That's where true joy comes from.
Yep. And there's a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt, and I'm sure many other people to that effect. It is not something that you can pursue. What you can pursue is wisdom and, you know, activities that in focus that involves your wisdom, that develops your wisdom. Things like mindfulness, things like reading your book, maybe my book too, understanding that and really integrating that as a priority in your life, not just, oh, something I can do on a weekend. Oh, well, you know, I'm a pretty good guy. You know, I rip people off during the week, but, you know, on Saturdays I go, you know, I go help out at whatever. That is important, and I'm sure the basis of survival ultimately for human civilization.
Yeah, and at the same time, we need to recognize that we're all human beings. We're all works in progress. We make mistakes. We give into temptation. We lose focus. But ultimately, it's that moral discipline, striving to get it right, striving to think more deeply, always re-examining our beliefs, the things we take for granted, engaging people that we may not agree with so that we can better understand where they're coming from, so that we don't become so calcified in our thinking or tribal in our relationships. It's really just looking to change relatively simple behavior patterns a little bit at a time, giving ourselves credit for being able to be more than we are, while being patient with ourselves for not being perfect yet. It's all about balance. It's all about mindset. And if we make the effort, we can see the change in our lives. But we have to start. You said earlier, where does it start? It just starts by starting. It's where
absolutely.
Wherever you are on the ladder.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep. I said the definition of a good person is somebody who's trying to be a better person. And you can apply that to athletics. You can apply it to music. You can apply it to business. But let's all apply it to our relationships and our day-to-day lives.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Tell the listeners where they can find more about you and reach you.
My website is my name, Yonasson Goldson, YonasonGoldson.com. Very active on LinkedIn, a little bit less on the other social media, but I'm always happy to continue the conversation with anyone who wants to reach out.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, and keep up the great work. I've really appreciated meeting you, and I hope we will have further conversations in the future. So shalom, God bless, and thank you for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.